Welcome back to CS50. So glad you came back. This is week one. My name is David Malin. For those of you just joining us, there are two handouts today, and on your way in, there were a couple of videos playing. So this is an example of one of these things called an internet meme, something that you sort of get in your inbox because someone thought it was cute or funny or clever, and so they forwarded it to you. A friend of mine sort of teases me a lot since I seem to catch on to these kinds of things that get forwarded about 2 years after they're funny. And I only recently discovered this thing called Where the Hell is Matt? It's actually not so much funny as it is rather moving. Long story short, this fellow has this very sort of goofy looking dance, and somehow or other he was convinced to go do this in as many places as possible. He even got corporate sponsorship in the end. We saw 2005's video as well as 2006's. There's also, I think, a 2008, which is particularly moving, to be honest, if only because he got such a following in all different countries that he actually had random strangers show up to each of the film sites and actually do that silly dance with him. But as you saw last week with our lolcats and the like, we made a conscious decision this year to introduce stupid internet forwards to the course as best as we could. We thought we would begin today with a video that follows up on the one we saw last week. I'm not sure, truth be told, how many weeks we can keep this up, but I'm sure if we do this enough, you will start adding me to your forward list. So what's funny about this one, I would say, is how carefully the speaker pronounces the mispronunciation. So I give you a YouTube clip.
You know the power saw, that when it comes to the power of the internet...
I hear there's rumors on the internets...
Not once, but at least twice, President Bush has inexplicably added an S.
We can have filters on internets.
Leading young whippersnappers to mock him.
Everyone's on the internets. Yeah, that's our fearless leader.
Woo! And now the leader dubbed Googler-in-Chief by the Wall Street Journal has struck again. During a CNBC interview, the president was asked if he ever Googles.
Occasionally. And one of the things that I've used on the Google is to pull up maps.
The Google? May be petty, but the Google had techno geeks agog. I wonder on which one of the internets he uses the Google, posted one.
He was just referring to it as the Google, like the Donald.
Forget the Donald.
But I'm the decider.
And when the decider says the Google, the editor who's working on a sixth edition of Bushisms is the man to call. Jacob Weisberg emailed back that he was eating the lunch when we called for an interview.
It's a little bit the way my mom talks about technology. It's sort of sweet, kind of endearing. She calls to tell you that she got an email.
President Bush said he uses the Google to look at satellite maps of his ranch in Crawford, Texas. Reminds me of where I want to be sometimes. But who are we to talk? I had to get my producer to help.
So we're downloading Google Earth. We're not sure if the president did this or knows how to do this. I don't know how to do this.
Next thing you know, we were zooming in on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
You practically can see him in there. He's on the internet.
Now, I'm no fan of the internets.
Comedians and internet wags have immortalized the internets.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
As for the Google, the company says it's flattered. He can call it whatever the heck he wants to call it. Besides, he's technically correct. There is more than one internet. Internet 2 is a better, faster network used by universities and others. The president's not the only politician to get tripped up by the internet.
It's a series of tubes.
The internet is a series of tubes through which goods and services travel.
Better to have those tubes tied than the president's tongue.
On the Google is
Jeannie Moos, the CNN, New York.
That's very interesting to see that. I forgot.
All right, so that's today's stupid internet forward. With respect to this, less comfortable, more comfortable, and in between, it kind of puts it all into perspective, perhaps, for those of you in the less comfortable end of the spectrum. So in addition to the two handouts outside, we have scratch boards for the Hacker Edition of Problem Set Zero available outside with a couple of the teaching fellows on your way out today. We also have blank forms if you forgot to tear that off of your own PS0. Sectioning is now online. We are not using the FAS sectioning tool. Being computer scientists, we wrote our own. Rather misleading. We will write our own on Wednesday, 5 p.m. But we're going to collect your data via a URL on the course's website. So simply go to cs50.net, check out the yellow link on the homepage, and that will lead you to the survey for sectioning preferences. Without further ado, let's dive in. So last week we looked at Scratch, which again was this sort of gentle introduction to programming. But more interesting than just the fact that you can point and click and drag to program were some of the ideas that underlie Scratch that you can actually deploy in, say, the first week of programming, using events, using threads, and other similarly sort of advanced mechanisms that, truth be told, we won't really get to for some time, if at all now, in the course, because with languages like C, C++, Java, it tends to take sort of a higher level of sophistication there, say, to actually redeploy those same ideas. But we'll be able to build on the works of others, libraries, so to speak, that others have written to nonetheless achieve some more sophisticated tasks with C, PHP, and JavaScript in the course. So let's sort of start with a high level question. So what is a program, if again the goal here is to learn how to program? So what is a program? Something you double click on your hard drive. What is it? It's, sorry, instructions? Okay, so it's a set of instructions that tells the computer to do something. It's another definition. What's a program? Yeah. So it's an algorithm, a procedure that sort of teaches the computer how to do something. In general, these programs serve purposes like making it easier for you to compute mathematics, making it easier for you to send messages, to write something up. So how did that program or programs like that get written? Well, someone sat down at a computer that itself had years worth of sort of years worth of development sitting on it, like an operating system and such, tools with which you can then build on top of to build new software. Well, what does it take then to write a program? Well, in its simplest form, you can literally sit down today on your own Mac, your own PC, or whatever you're running, pull up something as trivial as Notepad or TextEdit, and simply start typing commands. Now, those commands have to follow a certain set of conventions. They have to be written in a known language like C or C++ or any other type language. But then once you've actually sort of mastered that syntax and you speak that language and you bang out those commands, you go to the file menu, you go to save, and voila, you have a program embedded in some file like hello.c or hello.txt, txt. But it's not enough, right? Because if you then save that file, hello.txt, put it on your desktop and double-click it, is that program, whatever it is you wrote, going to run? Well, no, right? It's just going to pop open again, Notepad or whatever it is you wrote that program in, because what you wrote is called source code. And as we hinted at in Monday's lecture of last week, when you write a program, not only do you write the source code, this sort of English-like syntax that's nonetheless very precise, you then need to do something to that source code. And what is that thing you need to do? So you need to compile it. So there exist in this world programs called compilers, and they exist for various operating systems and various types of CPUs. And their purpose in life is to take source code that, again, resembles English. You double-click on that compiler, feed it this text file, like hello.txt, as its input. And what it then does is it takes that English-like syntax and converts it into zeros and ones, patterns that very specifically are understood by the computer on which you're running that compiler. So this was the example we gave last week, where on top left is a very simple, if not canonical, program written in C. So when I say we're writing in this English-like syntax, well, if the language in question is C, that snippet at top left is exactly what we're talking about. That is a program in C that I could very well copy and paste into a text file written with Notepad or something similarly trivial. But I then need to run that file, as this dark arrow suggests, through some other program whose purpose in life is to convert the stuff that's sort of pretty easy for a human to understand, even if it is a bit cryptic on first glance, into something that a computer understands. Now, how do you, with a program as short as that, sort of teach the computer how to actually display something on the screen, right? Last Monday, we talked about the notion that computers underneath the hood represent things like characters with just numbers, and numbers in turn with just bits, zeros and ones, magnetic particles, electrical charges, whatever the underlying implementation is. So how in the world, with just a few lines of English-like syntax, can you make all of that happen? Because clearly, there's nothing binary going on in this code that I myself wrote at top left. Well, at the end of the day, every computer, so far as we're concerned, has a CPU, a brain, right? And that brain, that CPU, understands a specific set of instructions. Add two numbers together, multiply two numbers together, and similarly, very basic building blocks. They also implement the notion of branching, like we saw in Scratch. So it's not just arithmetic, but it's also logical operations that they understand as well. Now, back in the day, you've probably all heard or heard your parents talk about this notion of punch cards, and similarly, now aged means of programming whereby you kind of do program those zeros and ones. Maybe not outright, but you're much closer to the hardware. You can't just type the word print and have something print to the screen. You actually have to sort of literally punch holes or have a machine punch holes in a card so that that card itself sort of represents those zeros and ones. Well, fast forward to sort of more modern days where we have languages like C and Java and other languages, we can now sort of express ourselves on a higher level because there's been 10, 20, 30 years worth of development by other smart people, computer scientists, programmers, who have sort of built on top of these basics, taking zeros and ones to something called assembly language, which we'll glance at later in the semester, moving from assembly language to languages like C, moving from C to even higher languages still, like PHP and other scripting languages, as they're called. So when we write a program like this, we're actually taking advantage of code that is programs that other people wrote. Some number of years ago, someone had to sit down and implement this function, this procedure called printf. And as you can kind of infer, printf is like sort of a mini program that someone else wrote that appears to print whatever it is you hand it in between parentheses and in between quotes. And the fact that someone else wrote that for us means that we can bootstrap ourselves with their work and start to do more interesting work still. What you'll see today and on Wednesday too is the core, CS50, we implemented our own library with functions, that is mini programs, that completely handle the process of asking the user, whoever's sitting at your keyboard, for a string, that is a sequence of characters. We wrote some code. We wrote some mini programs, aka functions, that actually get an integer from the user, or a real number from the user, so that you yourselves don't have to sort of roll these primitives yourselves and reinvent the wheel, which has been many times reinvented by other people who've programmed before you. So what then is the end result? Well, if you have these patterns of zeros and ones, they're going to be stored on some file on your desktop, not called hello.txt, but instead, in the Windows world, hello.exe. Inside that .exe file, when you double click it, is all these zeros and ones. And because the compiler was designed for a specific operating system, like Windows or Mac OS, and a specific CPU, like one of Intel's, those zeros and ones are in a pattern that, by design, are understood by that CPU. By contrast, if you take the program like AIM.exe, AOL Instant Messenger's program from a PC, put it on like a USB stick, transfer it to your friend's Macintosh, and then try double-clicking AIM.exe on the Mac, well, why, applying that same those same ideas, does it not work? Why does it trigger most likely some kind of error? You know, with corner case exceptions, if you're familiar with virtual machines and Fusion and things like that. Double click AIM.exe on a Mac. Like, why does it not work? Yeah?
Because it doesn't understand those zeros and ones. It's for the wrong machine.
Yeah, so the computer doesn't understand those patterns of zeros and ones. They're for the wrong machine. Now, you might push back if you're a bit more familiar with hardware today and say, wait a minute, didn't Apple recently move to Intel processors, x86 processors, CPUs that are identical pretty much to what's in PCs? Well, yes, that is true. But again, to this point of programmers from yesteryear having written a whole bunch of software that you, sort of a newer programmer, can build your own code on top of, well, the folks at Apple, for instance, have written a whole bunch of functions that are specific to Mac OS. And the folks at Microsoft and elsewhere have written functions, libraries, miniature programs that you can use but that are specific to Windows. So generally speaking, when you compile a program on a PC for a PC, it's only going to run there, and vice versa, same goes for a Mac. But there are exceptions still. For instance, your Scratch projects. Many of you have written them on PCs. Turns out if you take that .sb file when you save your project, it will in fact run on your friend's Mac or your friend's Linux box if they have jump through a few hoops to get things working. And that's because there are other languages like Scratch, or really the thing underneath it called Squeak, and Java that are quote unquote platform independent. But more on that in just a bit. So how are we in this course going to write programs? Well, very well could you sit down at your own Mac and PC, start typing in a text file, save that file, and then run it through a compiler. Generally though, what we're going to do in this course is use something known as Linux, a different operating system, sort of all the rage. It's been around for quite some time. Its interface, at least so far as you see it initially, is going to seem a little primitive. A step backwards, perhaps, because for the most part, you, for this course's purposes, are going to be interacting with it at the so-called command line. You're going to get a blinking prompt, and you're going to be typing commands at it more than you will, for instance, be clicking and dragging and opening folders, so to speak. Though you can do that, especially with some of the machines in the Science Center. So we have Harvard has, for instance, a whole bunch of Linux servers. These are just PCs that instead of running Windows are instead running Linux, which for the most part is free. Download it. There's different versions, different flavors of it, but it's called Linux in general. Well, there's a whole bunch of these things in the Science Center called collectively nice.fas.harvard.edu, the new instructional computing environment, which ironically has been around now for like 8 or 10 years, and it's still called NICE. There was ICE, which is just the instructional computing environment at Harvard, which is what I sort of grew up on here, and it was only decommissioned last year. So this is what we have now, and this is a bunch of servers, like 5 or 6, that are generally called nice.fas.harvard.edu, and when you try to pull one of these up by connecting to it remotely with special software we'll see today, well, you're sort of randomly assigned to one of those servers, and it's there that you'll actually do your work. Now, we decided it as a course this summer that rather than rely on nice.fas.harvard.edu, we're going to hop onto this sort of this wave of new technology called cloud computing. So if you've heard of this, even from me last week, what is cloud computing in general? It's one of these sort of sexy terms, more marketing than anything, but there actually is some really interesting computer science beneath it. Yeah. Okay, good. So cloud computing refers to your use of computing power, your use of computers that are not physically located, say, in your own office or on your own desk or even in your own building, but rather somewhere in the cloud, so to speak. Now, Google is taking a step forward into this. Microsoft is doing the same. Amazon, though, has perhaps been one of the forerunners of this. For the past few years, they've made available to the world, it's still in beta technically, but it is nonetheless fairly robust, something called their Elastic Computing. Wait, got the acronym wrong, didn't I? Let's Google it. Elastic Cloud Computing. Wow, I use it. Elastic Compute Cloud. Damn. All right, Elastic Compute Cloud, which since I've clearly been spending so much time with it lately, is precisely what we're going to use in the course. So what does this mean? Well, it means we're going to be replacing, for so far as the course is concerned, fas.harvard.edu and FAS's servers, and we're going to replace it with our own infrastructure called cs50.net. And we're going to borrow some of these same ideas whereby you will connect, as you'll soon see with software, to one of these computers in the cloud. But it's not going to be a server that Harvard itself hosts. It's not even one that we know physically where it is. All we know that it's somewhere, in fact, on the East Coast. And that server to which you're going to connect is then going to have a whole bunch of other servers or virtual servers behind it. And we, just like FAS, are going to dispatch you sort of automagically to whatever server has the fewest students on it at the moment so that you have access to sort of as much computing power as is currently available. But what's pretty neat about this is that for certain problem sets, like our forensics problem set, where you actually have to do a lot of file I/O, you have to analyze lots of data on disk, or for our crypto problem set, where you actually have to compute a lot of numbers toward an end of cracking some passwords. Well, for those problem sets which sort of demand bigger, faster, more servers, literally will we, the staff, be able to fire up, that is, boot up more machines, more virtual machines, literally by just typing some commands at the prompt. And these are things that we'll demo before long. This is particularly compelling because these days, for an enterprise environment, like a big commercial website, you typically pay someone to first of all, store all of your servers in a data center. And this is a big warehouse, usually with lots of security, with lots of air conditioning, with lots of electricity, and then lots of cages where you physically store all of your servers, interconnect them. But in addition to paying those people for that co-location, so to speak, you're also paying those people for that electricity, for that air conditioning, and so forth. Plus, you're buying those servers. And in the event that your website or whatever it is you're running becomes suddenly popular overnight, those of you, for instance, who read Slashdot, this sort of very popular, geeky online online news website, there's this thing called the Slashdot effect, which whereby if you're lucky or unlucky enough to get mentioned on Slashdot's homepage, you immediately, because of all these people who are sort of constantly clicking refresh on that page, have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of hits all in one day, which very often completely brings someone's infrastructure down to their knees. Now, what's the solution? Well, don't get Slashdotted, obviously, or buy twice as much hardware as you actually need usually, because on occasion, maybe twice as many people will visit your website. But what's sort of the trade-off? What's sort of the downside of that approach, sort of having too much capacity? What's that? It's not particularly cost-effective, right? Sure, you can handle those spikes, but if those spikes only happen once in a while, is it really worth literally spending twice as much money, buying twice as many servers? Moreover, the more servers you have, what's more likely to happen over time? Even if it's combinatorically, like what's going to happen if you own physically more devices, mechanical devices? They're going to break. I mean, you have tens or hundreds of servers. Odds are, and the more you have of them, the more likely are you are to have something break in the middle of the day. And so this is why this idea of cloud computing, being able to no longer have to own or even physically manage your own hardware, is not only sort of sexy in this academic context, whereby we can talk about the very technologies that we're actually having you use during the semester, but we can also scale ourselves on demand, literally within seconds, to handle increased loads, whether it's because a problem set is due and it's Thursday night and we realize, wow, time to fire up some more virtual machines, or simply because your site or whatever it is you're hosting is increasingly popular. So with that said, this is me with Photoshop procrastinating what was once this nice.fas.harvard.edu will now become in the course this, which I dare say which I dare say is an improvement for that building perhaps. So see us So cs50.net. What we're going to do is, this is not yet live, but we're going to be rolling it out over the course of this week and next. So what I'm going to be doing today is actually using FAS's infrastructure, nice.fas, to show you exactly the same kinds of interactions and programs that we could very well write on cs50.net before long. But to make this a bit more clear, let me paint this picture. So this is a simple little shareware program that allows you to sketch out network topologies. And if you are already thinking that this kind of stuff appeals to you, well, CS 143, networking, is something that one could take after this course, or say CS 61 and 51. I'm going to go ahead and choose just a basic network diagram template. I'm just going to click all the defaults here so that I just get a blank template. And this is really just a graphics program, but that lends itself to marking up network diagrams. If you're familiar with Microsoft's Visio, think Visio, but much, much simpler. So what we're talking about here is the following. We have, say, this thing called the internet, which generally folks describe as or depict as a cloud. I'm going to go ahead and edit text here. Well, we'll have the internets up there in the cloud, sure. So what does this mean? So this is the internet or the internets. Harvard itself is on this network, but we're going to abstract away some of the specifics. Otherwise, this will very quickly get complicated. But somewhere on this campus is little old you on your laptop, and you have some kind of connection to the internet. And if we really wanted to waste time, we could start adding things like wireless routers and all this. But this sort of suffices for this discussion. Well, then we need things like servers in here, because what we're describing, even though they're virtual, might as well be depicted as actual physical boxes, because these virtual machines, these illusions of computers that we are literally firing up using Amazon's toolkit, they actually are computers, but they're computers that are implemented in software. That is, rather than write a silly little program like Hello World, someone actually wrote a program that simulates an actual Intel x86 computer. Took a long time, but these things exist. And that software, whether it's called VMware or in our case Xen, which is freely available code, it's simply software that's running on someone's physical hardware. In the case of EC2, on Amazon's own equipment. But you've all probably noticed, and we mentioned even last week, that there's this trend in industry of having computers not just with one CPU these days, but sometimes with two CPUs. And even sometimes those individual CPUs have multiple what? So cores, quote unquote, which for our purposes in this course pretty much means that a dual core CPU is pretty much equivalent to having two CPUs, albeit with some subtle differences. So that means your computer can, per unit of time, per second, per microsecond, do twice as much because it has access to two brains. But it doesn't really take all that much effort these days for you, for instance, to run AOL Instant Messenger and maybe Facebook and some browser and Microsoft Word and maybe even 10 other programs. Because again, remember from Wednesday, your computer can multitask because it's a multi-threaded environment. It can sort of create that illusion of multiple things all happening simultaneously. But you are sort of the bottleneck in that equation, right? You can only type or instant message or email someone so quickly. So even on your own super fancy brand new computers, most of your CPU cycles, if not RAM, are going unused. And so there's this really interesting opportunity now in industry because of Intel and these other companies cramming more and more computational power into computers that most ordinary people don't use. Well, what virtual machines allow you to do is take one sort of souped up box and chop it up logically into multiple computers, virtual computers, that then individual people can then connect to as though they were their own computer. So what that means for us is that, yes, there's some big server out there on which not only our virtual machines are going to be, but probably other customers of Amazon's and the like, but we can still think about them as servers like this. So what the CS50.net is going to be is it too has some connection to the internet, but so that we can load balance, so that we can spread some 300 plus students across not just one server but multiple ones, what we'll also have in this picture is some additional servers, say like this and like this and like this. And each of these guys in turn will be networked in the cloud, so to speak, but via TCP, IP, Ethernet, all these same pieces of jargon that you're familiar with from your own computers, but so that it doesn't matter to you which one you end up getting connected to, we'll have, say, what we'll call, not a computer in this case, because that's a little too generic, but rather a file server, which sort of does as it says. These servers, in the meantime, will also be logically connected back here so that when you actually connect to CS50.net, you're coming in from the top of the picture in the internet, you're hitting that front-end server, as we'll call it, and then you're being sort of automatically dispatched to any of the machines behind that server. And these servers are all themselves going to be running Linux. So what does this mean? Well, this means that after some problem set is due, so Friday night, 7 p.m., except for people who are taking some late days, well, what this means is that we as a course can save some money by just turning this server off and therefore deleting these logical lines. That's still CS50.net. The next person who connects will still just get automatically assigned to one of those two servers. And if we really want to cut corners, although then we risk having potential downtime if that one remaining box dies, we could even par the setup down to this. So there's this really amazing dynamism you can have when your computers are no longer physical devices on your desk or in your data center, but rather these virtual servers that you can control literally by typing commands. Now, what does this mean for us? Or really anyone who uses this? Well, not to dwell on sort of the finances of it all, but this is particularly compelling. If we want to get a virtual machine, that is the illusion of a real machine that's got, say, just under 2 gigs of RAM, about a 1 gigahertz CPU, and 160 gigabytes of storage space, well, we're going to pay 10 cents per hour to do that. And if we want to have two such machines because we have twice as many students trying to do their problem sets at once, well, that's 20 cents. An hour. So that's only a few dollars per day, a few tens of dollars per week. And if you sort of do the math, there's very interesting sort of economic motivations here too, because if you have some really big project, or we in this case, a short-lived course, well, we can just fire up these resources on demand and then get rid of them. And so long as we're making copies of sort of the machine images that we keep loading up, well, it's literally going to be this semester as simple as firing up individual commands. And what's really neat, if you haven't totally sort of concluded me the biggest geek here, what we'll even be able to do for some of the more comfortable students in the class, those of you who really would like to not only connect to these Linux boxes, but sort of run your own, which isn't necessarily possible unless you want to buy your own computer and install Linux on it yourself, we'll also be able to give some of you, if you would like, your own virtual machines. So your own server in this picture will similarly wire you up to CS50.net, and then we'll give you what's called root access, administrator access, so that you can pretty much go nuts with your virtual computer, do anything with it that you want, run websites on it, run email accounts on it, really just futz around, and it will be in complete isolation from anyone else. And all of these things are not currently possible in a shared infrastructure like that a typical university would have. So hence the direction in which we're going. So we're actually thankful that both Amazon and Google have both generously offered to whittle down that 10 cents per hour for us into even less. So more on that to come. Any questions on this notion of cloud computing or what it means to actually have a virtual rather than physical machine? No? All right. So how do you actually use this? Who cares? These machines exist somewhere out there on the internet. How do you actually connect to them? Well, starting next week, you will run a program called an SSH, Secure Shell program, that's going to connect your computer, whether it's a laptop or desktop, to this foreign server, wherever it is on the East Coast of the United States. Again, Amazon sort of hosting it all for us. This is a program specifically called PuTTY. It's one of the most popular SSH programs because it's free, and you can download it with just a single file. There's not even an installer. Those of you who run macOS already have an SSH program built into your computer. If you go to your hard drive and go to Applications and then go to Utilities, there's something in there called Terminal. Terminal will bring up a window very similar to what you're about to see, and you can type the same kinds of commands there. But more on that via handouts as well as in sections next week. So what this is going to do when I connect not to CS50.net for today's demos, but rather to Harvard's infrastructure, I'm going to log in using a username, in this case CS50. I'm then going to type a password, which is not going to appear on the screen. And then you get this, well, it turns out, non-blinking prompt, but the idea is the same. And this is the interface now to one of Harvard's physical servers that are located somewhere in the basement. So this cluster called nice.fas.harvard.edu means that this server is physically located somewhere in the Science Center's basement, and I have connected to it. And in fact, if I run the command hostname, I'll actually see that the specific name of this server just happens to be ICE2. Because there's ICE1, ICE3, ICE4, ICE5, and that just means that that's the specific box to which we've connected. But they all look the same, and they all have a file server that's sort of making sure that my files are available to me on any of those machines. Because what you get when you have an account on a Linux box is not only a username and password, but with it what's called a home directory, sort of your personal storage space, just like on a PC you might have the thing called My Documents when you log into that PC. So there's a whole bunch of commands that you can type to actually interact now with your account. So for instance, if I want to, and just hitting enter is just going to move the cursor down, if I want to create a folder, there's no more mouse clicking, at least for the next couple of weeks, but rather there's the more esoteric command, mkdir, for make directory. If I want to go ahead and make a directory called CS50, mkdir, CS50, enter, and nothing seems to happen, but if I now want to do the equivalent of double clicking and opening that folder, what I actually want to do in this environment is change directory, aka CD, to CS50. Hit enter, and then notice that my prompt, which is just incessantly reminding me who I am and where I am, which is useful, frankly, when you start to have multiple windows up at once, notice in parentheses it's telling me I'm in tilde, the little squiggly symbol, slash CS50. So henceforth, that little tilde is going to denote your home directory, sort of your default locations, My Documents in the world of Windows. Slash just means take a step forward, and now we're inside of the CS50 directory specifically, or folder. If I type ls, take a guess. What is the ls command going to do, sort of assuming that brevity here is key? Just lists. It lists the contents of this folder. Those of you who grew up with DOS or have played with it, DIR, directory, is the same thing in the DOS world. So nothing seems to happen. Why? Well, there's nothing there, right? So this isn't really magic. It's just more a matter of remembering what these commands are. So just to summarize here, CD changes directory, CP will eventually see copies files, LS lists files, mkdir makes directories, MV. Move, which is move to used to physically move a file from one place to another or rename it turns out. So if you type MV space apple space banana, what that's going to do is rename the file called apple to banana, for instance. So these programs, these commands take command line arguments, words after another, one after the other, at the so-called command line, the blinking prompt, that modify their behavior. So if we type mkdir and just hit enter, the computer's going to yell at us because it's going to ask, well, what do you want to make? What's the name of the directory? Whereas some commands like ls, by default, can just be typed alone, and they'll execute some behavior. PWD. Present Working Directory. If you've completely forgotten where you are and on computer systems that don't remind you incessantly in parentheses, this will tell you really where you are, not only relative to your home directory, but in this case, relative to everybody else's directories on this server. So in a nutshell, Harvard, because it has 30,000 users on the FAS systems, they don't just dump everyone's home directories into one big folder. Rather, they have hierarchies, and they use the first letter and the second letter of people's usernames to sort of segregate things. Well, this just means that my home directory technically is in a folder called NFS, as you'd see here, /home, which is where everybody's home directories are, /C/S, because my username is CS50, /CS50, it appears that I've now created a folder that's called the same thing as my home directory, but perhaps no surprise there. So sort of mundane details that we point out now, only so that you sort of get a sense or wrap your mind around what it is you're interacting with here. So let's go ahead and actually now move some code over here. Or actually, we can demo that they're actually... Oh, that won't work. We'll show that later. What we'll do is I'm going to copy from another directory altogether, and you'll find that the problem sets in the course will walk you through these steps. So this is not going to be a matter of remembering the esoteric commands that we typed in lecture quite recently. This command here is going to copy. Then that really long string is just the path, so to speak, sort of the Linux version of C:\something. To where today's lecture source code is, which is apparently in something called public HTML, lectures, weeks, one, source. And star just means grab everything. Dot means put it here. So you have source, space, destination. The source is that really long path. Where do I want to dump these files? Well, apparently I want to dump them right here, which is dot. If I go ahead and hit enter and now type ls, what we'll see is all of these files that I wrote in advance in preparation for lecture today, one of your printouts documents these same files. So let's try this now. So what I'm going to do now is not use TextPad or Notepad, because those are client-side programs on my own Mac or PC, but rather I'm going to use a text editor that's inside of the server in the Science Center, an editor, so to speak, a command line editor. And the one that will promote to most of you early in the semester is called Nano, because it's very simple. If you've ever used Pine for email, which these days most of you haven't, it's as simple as Pine is or was for email. Nano, if I hit enter, is sort of the Notepad of Linux, right? It really doesn't get any simpler than this for actually typing stuff in a window. Now, it's a little ugly down here, but the conventions are anytime you see a caret symbol, that means hit the control key. So what this means is, this is my little cheat sheet at the bottom. If I want to exit this program called Nano, it's control X. And what's going to happen then is I'll be prompted, do you want to save this file? And if so, what do you want to call it? So save modified buffer. So this is going to be a theme, especially in this environment of Linux. There are user friendliness, let's say, or clarity wasn't necessarily the goal of the folks who originally implemented most of these programs and commands, but rather succinctness was, for instance, mkdir, and using terminology like buffers and whatnot that make perfect sense to someone who's on the system all the time. But for those neophytes in the room, this is just something you'll get used to. Yes, I'm going to save it. I'm going to name it foo. F-O-O, enter, and now I'm back at my prompt. If I now type ls, notice that just like having saved a file would do for me, I now have a file called foo at top left. If I want to open it again, I'd run not nano alone, but nano foo, enter. And here I am again. If you want to save, again here, you know, save might have been the reasonably named option. Instead here, write out is the command for saving a file. So control O will save it. Enter will confirm the name. Control X will then quit. So some basics that, again, we'll recap in sections and in various handouts. But let's do something interesting now. So I argued earlier that perhaps the simplest program we could write is this one here. So how can we actually go about doing this? Well, let's go ahead and run Nano. I'm going to go ahead and now just type this thing out verbatim. So include standard io.h. And I have no idea for now what this even means, but I remember I was supposed to type int, then something called main, then int argc, char argv brackets, open curly brace, a few spaces, then something like printf, hi world, and then close quote, close parenthesis, semicolon. With a couple of exceptions, that's exactly what was in that sample slide a moment ago. So there's clearly some cryptic syntax here, less so if you're coming to the course with a background in, say, Java or AP Computer Science, but we'll dig in deeper before long. I'm going to go ahead and hit Control X. Hit Y to save. I'm going to call this, let's say, hi.c. The convention now, because I'm writing programs in the C language, means save them not with .txt or .doc or something like that, but .c is the convention. Enter. All right, now what I'm going to do is try to run this thing. So hai.c, the equivalent of double-clicking this thing. All right, so permission denied. All right, what's the problem with what I just did intuitively? Yeah, so this is just a file. This is as though I double-clicked on foo.txt on my desktop thinking that would run it, but really, I need to actually compile this thing first. Well, the means by which we compile this thing is going to be to use a program called GCC. So GCC is perhaps the most popular compiler in the world of Unix and Linux. It's quite powerful. If you're coming at us from the world of Java, Java C was the compiler from that world. If you've done Windows development, Visual Studio, for instance, is sort of a Windows version of this idea. GCC is its name. All lowercase is how you type it. If I want to compile this program, I'm going to type GCC space hi dot C, and then that's it. Because when I then hit enter, assuming I've made no syntactical mistakes, that is, typos in this file, I'm going to get my blinking prompt. And then, rather disappointingly, I am going to see a new file. In fact, it's color-coded to make clear that it's a program, not a text file. And it's apparently called a.out. So let's run this. Well, how do you run a program? Well, as we've seen with all these commands, you generally just type its name. So let's run a.out, ignoring why it's called that for now. What happened? Well, I actually hit the command there. A.out. So almost, right? It works, but it's kind of ugly. Like, if we want to be really anal here, what's an aesthetic we could probably improve upon here? All right, so it would probably be nice if my prompt actually comes down on the next line, like every other command we've been playing with so far. So I'm going to run nano, hi.c. I'm going to go in here. Notice now that I named it .c, the computer knows, oh, this is source code. This isn't just some silly text file. Let me try to draw your attention to interesting parts of it by color coding it, aka syntax highlighting. So even though this is a fairly simple environment, people have made enhancements over the years such that if your computer is properly configured, everything that sort of logically distinct from other pieces of syntax will be color-coded accordingly. And we'll tease those things apart soon. But it turns out there are these things known as escape sequences in C and in other languages, whereby if you want to move the cursor to a new line, you need to explicitly tell the computer that. And the means by which you do that is you have to tell it some special code, because there's no character on the keyboard that says, put a new line here. There's the Enter key. But that doesn't actually display. You would never type enter in your program. But rather, the shorthand notation is backslash n. Let me go ahead and save this with control X, Y to confirm, enter. And now I'm going to run a.out. And voila. So two-step process, right? We need to recompile the program. So I'm going to type GCC, hi.c, enter. Nothing seems to happen. If I run a.out again, though, we have now a marginal improvement on this. So, any questions on at least the basic flow of what we did? That was meant to be sort of a quick and dirty example of how to get yourself started. Yeah? Oh, good question. All right, so always the corner case, right? What if you actually want to display backslash n for whatever reason, or a backslash literally? Well, what could we do? Well, it turns out, right, there's kind of this quandary, right? Because if backslash apparently has special meaning, whereby it's an escape sequence, where backslash something means do something special, what if you just want to put a backslash? Well, the world thought of that too. Backslash, backslash, n. This time, if I recompile this GCC of hi.c, and then run a.out, there I get my literal backslash n. And you can do this sort of ad nauseum with backslash, 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 and you'll just get a whole bunch of them so long as you do it in pairs. And if you do an odd number, one of them will have some special meaning. Good question. Other questions along those lines? No? All right, so let's take things up a notch here. So rather than just do these sort of basic steps, how to write a program in C, well, what if we actually want to give it a less stupid-looking name, right? Not all that compelling to tell your friends, go click on my program. It's called a.out, which is simply just the convention there. But you can certainly control the names of your program. So what I'm actually going to do now is actually run GCC and not just hi.c, but I'm going to specify with what's called a command line switch, dash O in this case for output, that I want to call this thing hi.exe. for instance. I'm going to hit Enter. Notice that if I type ls, a.out's still there. So I had to delete it if I really cared to get rid of it. But now I have hi.exe. The star at the end of it is just my terminal window, as this thing is called. It's little shorthand notation for saying that's not the name of the file, but it means it's executable. So I'm going to run hi.exe, Enter. And now that seems to work, albeit with the tweak we made a moment ago. But this is kind of strange, right? This whole notion of exe is a Windows thing. That's how a computer on the Windows world distinguishes one file type from another. Linux computers don't really need this, certainly for executables. So suppose I wanted to call this not hi.exe, but hi. I could do this. But just to reinforce some of these fundamentals today, let's just rename the copy we have. So what was the command for renaming a file? Move. So sort of not what you would expect it to be called, but mv hi.exe is going to now say, if I just hit Enter, missing destination file operand after hi.exe. So again, acclimate yourself to this kind of jargon if you're sort of new to this world. It just means at the end of the day that we forgot the second argument. If I want to rename hi.exe to hi, I'm going to hit Enter. I'm going to hit ls. And voila, now my program is called hi. So just some basic Linux basics. So let's now take one step further. So we will, as your programs get more sophisticated, actually start using a utility called make, which is a program that itself calls GCC for you. For now, this isn't going to be all that helpful other than the fact that it's going to save you the trouble of typing dash O. In other words, I'm going to go ahead and remove a.out. I'm going to remove hi, just so I can start with a clean slate. So I have no executable programs. But if I type make hi, what make is going to do is assume, if I want to make a program called hi, let's assume that the file in which that program is written is going to be called hi.c. So let's go ahead and compile that for the user. You're about to see some cryptic commands because we've automated some of this on FAS's system. But notice that the very first word that was just outputted is, in fact, GCC. There's a bunch of other command line arguments there which are going to be useful when your programs get more sophisticated. You're going to be able to debug them because of that first switch. You're going to be able to link in, so to speak, code that we, the staff, have written by way of some of those other commands. But notice at the end, what it's done is it's automatically spit out dash O hi for me. So all this is going to do, to be clear, is just automate. Begin to automate processes for us. Initially, you can type whichever approach you want, and certainly the problem set will walk you through that. So Nano is perhaps the simplest of these editors. You will see me generally in lecture use something called Vim, just because it's what I grew up on when I took CS50. Emacs is an even more powerful tool that other people like similarly. You are completely welcome in the course to use any of them. We'll preach Nano in the problem sets just because it's the simplest to use, but it is certainly not a requirement to use those tools. And in sections, perhaps, we'll walk you through some of those other ones. So let's tease, if we could, this apart for just a moment. So here is an excerpt from something I typed at the very beginning of my file. So let's actually go back into this, but let's go to the prefabbed one called hi1.c. So you do have printouts of all of this. And what I did was I tried to shrink things down as best as possible for the sake of trees today. So each of in your handout that has source code like this, on the left-hand side is a printout of one file. On the right-hand side is a printout of another file. It's double-sided and so forth. You'll also notice that in your printouts, there are numbers on the left-hand column of every page. Those are line numbers. They're purely there for reference. So what I can do in lecture, for instance, or the TFs in section, is we can say, OK, look at line 14. I know it's line 14 because my program is telling me. We put it in the printout so that you too can see it. Do not write line numbers when you write code. So those of you who have ever programmed in BASIC might recall that BASIC actually has you number your lines like 0, 10, 20, 30, 40. And this was sort of a poor man's approach to sort of leaving room for more code down the road. If you number your lines 10, 20, 30, 40, and you decide, oh, I should really go back and add that feature, well, it's kind of a pain to renumber every one of your lines. If you leave these gaps, though, things will just kind of squeeze in. No longer necessary with languages like this. So here's the prefabbed version. This is clearly way more than I typed in my own version when I did it quick and dirtily. What is that stuff? All right, so these are comments, right? So sort of more basic stuff that you'll henceforth just take for granted. But in C, any time you want to write something in your program that the compiler should just outright ignore, but is useful nonetheless for humans to have there, you do /*, and then you can put whatever the heck you want after that, up until the point where you put a */. So anything between slash star and star slash is a comment, and it is ignored by the compiler. So people adopt various stylistic conventions. Style is a topic we'll talk about over the course of the semester. Ultimately, it's up to you how you sort of stylize your code, but most important, we'll see, is consistency for readability's sake. So all this stuff at the top is just sort of an FYI to whoever's looking at this file, what it is, who it's by, what it's called, and so forth. Down here is the actual program itself. So there's apparently this first line, include standard io.h, then there's this int main, then all this stuff in parentheses, and then printf. Well, the useful jargon for today is, for instance, this thing. Printf is an example of what? So this is like a mini program, to put it sort of playfully, but it's a function. So a function is sort of a mini program that someone else wrote that you can quote unquote call or invoke to do whatever task it was designed to do. The reason for this is that this saves me the trouble of teaching the computer that if you see a pattern of bits that represent the number 65, go ahead and output the capital letter A. All of that is done for you because someone else took the trouble to implement printf, for instance. Now, functions are generally structured as follows. You write the name of the function, then in parentheses you put zero or more arguments or parameters. And those arguments or parameters, things separated by commas, actually influence the behavior of the function, right? The guy or person who wrote printf many years ago had no idea what you might want to print down the road, so he or she sort of left a placeholder, a variable of sorts called a parameter, whereby you can tell the function what it is you want printed. The convention here is that if you want to print a sentence, aka a string, everything's got to go between double quotes, inside of parentheses, and then the last thing, and you'll think it lame for even dwelling on this, is that every line like this must end with a semicolon. And mark our words, even if you've programmed before, all of us in this room on staff have made some stupid mistake at 2 a.m. and in the middle of the night, spent 20 minutes trying to figure out what's wrong with our code, and you kick yourself 21 minutes later when you realize that you left off something stupid, like a semicolon. So this sort of speaks, too, to the reason we begin with something like Scratch, which sort of protects yourself from these kinds of stupidities. But you will see that this precision ultimately is very important, right? A computer, as we said last week, can't really guess a number off the top of your head. It can't sort of figure, oh, David probably meant to put a semicolon there. Most languages, most programs are not going to make those assumptions. They're only going to do what you tell them to do. And if you don't tell them to stop reading a statement, they're going to assume that everything that follows that parenthesis belongs to the same structure, and it probably shouldn't. So if I want to go ahead and compile this prefab program, make hi1, or I could simply run gcc hi1.c, that's going to execute a whole bunch of, it's going to create a whole bunch of syntax for me. If I run hi1, we indeed have my prefab version of this code. Well, let's take things one step further, though. Rather than just to look at hi1.c, which we've seen before, let's take a look at something that is a bit more interesting. So notice that what I did include in the slides for reference is the following. So testament to this course's independence of a textbook per se, there are very good references online. Perhaps the best of them for this kind of stuff is linked under resources on the course's website. It's called cppreference.com. It actually focuses on C++, which is sort of a superset of C. It's a newer version with more features, but there's a whole section on that website dedicated to C. And what you will see, no pun intended, if you go to this website is pretty much a completely free reference for all this kind of stuff. Even the best of us don't memorize every one of these little details, which is why we tend to go quickly through some of the minutiae in class, because it's just not that compelling to memorize some of this stuff. But in bottom left here of this website, you'll see standard C library. And if I forget how it is printf works, because it's actually more powerful than we've seen here, I'm going to go to, let's see, standard CIO. IO meaning input output, which probably means that, printing is output, so let's click on printf, and what you'll see here is like the manual, the user's manual for this function, and clearly can do way more, but notice you'll see, and we'll play with more examples of these over time, tell you what exactly can go in parentheses and what those various things slash T gives you, take a guess? a tab character. So just hitting tab won't give you a tab per se necessarily. So backslash T will actually print a tab. Backslash quote. Why do we need backslash quote? Right, so if we actually want to print a literal quote, that's kind of problematic if in hi1.c, or the one I rolled a moment ago, notice that we actually are using double quotes to demark strings. And if you're familiar with HTML, you can't just change these to single quotes, because single quotes in the world of C are only used for individual, single characters. If you want multiple characters in a row, it's called a string, and you need to have the double quotes. So if we actually want to put a double quote in the string, for no reason, like, oh, hi, maybe we want to quote that. We can't do this, because this, as you might imagine, would confuse a computer, because where does one begin, where does one end? They're nested. Well, if you're insistent that you want to have this nesting, just escape, so to speak, that one, escape that one, save the file, make hi1, rerun hi1, and now we have oh, hi, world. So the same idea. And there are other escape sequences still. So let's actually do something more interesting now, sort of like we began to do with Scratch by building up. So I'm going to go ahead and open up math1.c. Now, thankfully, computers can do way more than arithmetic, because otherwise it really wouldn't have been a compelling example here. But what this does show us is that we still have access to these primitives. So all that stuff at the top is just comments. So it's mostly fluff up there. I do still have this line here, and it turns out that in this case, actually, let's go back for a moment to hi1.c. The reason I have this line here, include standard io.h, is because by default, the compiler, GCC, might think that printf is a function I wrote, because we'll see on Wednesday how you can write your own functions. What, by including this line here, what this is doing is giving me access to a whole library, so to speak, of code that other people wrote. So that file, standard IO, stdio.h, lives somewhere on the Linux server. Someone else wrote it. And defined in that file, or technically declared in that file, is a function, a miniature program called printf. And then probably in some other file elsewhere, at least years ago, was also a file called standardio.c. Because inside of that .c file were the actual lines of code that that person wrote to implement this notion of printing. But we don't know, we don't care where it is on the system. Because it's sort of built into the C language now, the so-called standard library, we simply need to include that at the top. And I bring that up now because this program here is not printing, we actually don't need this line in this particular case, because all I'm doing is arithmetic. And that you get for free out of the box. So not hard to imagine that this program declares a variable called x, declares a variable called y, gives them the values 1 and 2, sums them up, stores the new one in a variable c, a z. But why is this a pretty lame program? All right, so it doesn't do anything per se. It does crunch numbers, but then it doesn't hand them back to the user. It doesn't print them out. It doesn't save them. Because if I run this thing, gcc of dash o math1 of math1.c, enter. Notice if I do an ls, I do get a program called math1. If I now run math1, yeah, that's great. Okay, did it work? Maybe, probably. Not a very useful program. So how can we improve upon that? So what can we do to sort of build on that? Well, not only can you print strings by just putting them between quotes, you can also print sort of formatted data, like numbers, which tend to maybe want to be formatted in a certain way, like you might do in Excel. So these are a whole bunch of format strings, which we certainly won't walk through one at a time, because I can't imagine something more dull. But we can pull out a couple highlights. If you want to print, using printf, an individual character that itself is stored in a variable, well, you use %c. We'll see in a moment. If you want to print a digit, like an integer, you use %d. If you want to print a real number, aka a floating point number, you use %f. And that's sort of the pattern. And if you forget what any of these mean, and even I forget sometimes what some of the more arcane ones are, well, you look it up in the manual, for instance, that we saw a moment ago. So let's take a look now at math2.c, which is sort of a slightly improved version of this. So a bunch of lines. The top ones are just comments. The rest is copy-paste from the previous line. I do have standard io.h included here because I wanted the files to be pretty much identical except for that last line. But you can argue it wasn't necessary in the previous one. But this time it is, because notice that my last task in this program is to tell the computer, spit out by printing the value of z. Well, you wouldn't just do this, to be clear, which might be one's first instinct. You could do something like this, but take an easy guess. Why is that clearly wrong? What's that going to print? Z, right? Not hard to imagine. All right, well, we could do this, and maybe that's a little more reasonable, because you can kind of tell printf, you go deal with this, what this is. But even that's not quite good enough, because you kind of have to provide printf and functions like it with hints as to what's in that variable. You obviously know, because you created it a line before. But you have to tell printf how you want to display that variable. And so you do this with one of these format strings, like %d, quotes, and then remember, if you have multiple arguments to a function, you separate them by commas, and what do I want to plug in to that placeholder, that format string? Well, the value of z. So let's go ahead and save this. Let's go ahead and gcc-o math2, math2.c, enter. Now I'm going to go ahead and run math. Oh, and incidentally, you'll see me to save time hitting tab a lot. You can't quite see it, but when you see long lists like this, it means I hit tab after typing a letter. There are all these nice little built-in tricks with Linux. When I type M tab, it sort of tries to autocomplete and shows me all the commands on the system that I can type that begin with M. If I go a little further, like MA, I'll get a shorter list, MAT, shorter list still, until finally I can figure out for myself what it is, math 2. So close, but still pretty ugly. You can argue it's correct. I can argue back that it's ugly. How do we fix? Yeah, so we just toss in that backslash n. So right after the format string, a little of this. You'll also notice another trick, bang g. If you do an exclamation point, that means execute the last command that started with this letter. Another time-saving trick, especially if you like to pick these tricks up quickly. That executed the same command. I now run math 2. And now I, in fact, have a working calculator. Not a very advanced calculator. It's always going to give the same result. But again, building blocks. So what else can you do arithmetically? Obviously, the basics there. But what's that fifth one? What's that last one? So this percent sign isn't a percent in the percentages sense, but rather modulo, or remainder. So it turns out that if you do something like x mod y, or x percent y, what that's going to do is divide y into x, but rather than return the answer, it's going to return the remainder. So for instance, if you do 4 divided by 5, what's the remainder from grade school there? Well, it's 4. Right, but what's the actual answer if you do 4 divided by 5? Well, it's 0, because 5 can't go into 4 any number of times. It goes in 0 times. But if you actually want to get back not the answer per se, but the remainder that would have been computed or left over from that operation, you use x percent y instead of x divide y. And we'll see that beyond just simple arithmetic, that actually has really powerful uses. For instance, it allows you to check if a number is even or odd quickly. It allows you to do a whole bunch of other things still. But more on that when we get to more interesting examples. This chart is kind of overwhelming, but it's meant as a reference. So there's a whole bunch of these operators, plus, minus, division, and a whole bunch of other syntax that has some native priority to it. So if you have a line of code that has multiple symbols in it, there is a ranking that the world has decided on years ago as to which operator should happen first. So we all know from grade school that multiplication should come before addition or subtraction if you just have x times y plus z. Right? You know that you're supposed to do x times y first. Well, there's a whole chart of precedence here that we'll touch on as we come encounter these symbols, but know that there is a formal definition as to what should happen first. It's not necessarily left to right. But we can do things more interesting still with printf. So let's tease this one apart a little further. This is kind of cryptic, this sort of syntax here. So we'll look at this by way of example. But when you start to get not integers, but floating point values, that is real numbers that by nature can be infinitely long, well, that's problematic for computers. Why is it problematic that real numbers or irrational numbers can be infinitely long for computers? Why is that problematic? Right, so at some point, the computer has to stop spending bits storing that value. If you have an infinitely long value, like pi, for instance, a computer is going to have a pretty hard time storing pi literally, because how many digits does pi have? Well, an infinite number. How many bits do you need for each of those digits, maybe? 8 bits maybe, although that's a bit of a white lie. But if the number itself is infinitely long, goes on forever, the implication is you need an infinite number of bits to represent it perfectly. And that's certainly not going to fly in computers. So you have this built-in imprecision with computing when it comes to actually dealing with real numbers as opposed to integers. It's sort of like your calculator. Your calculator only costs so much money, and what you get for your money is sort of translates to how many digits it can fit. A graphing calculator versus a cheaper calculator, at some point there's sort of a line drawn in the sand. And in general, computers use how many bits to store a number? If you know. So you've heard of 32-bit computers, even if you have no clue what that actually means. Many of your computers are 32-bit, though increasingly 64. That means that a number stored in a 32-bit computer is itself stored with 32 bits. Now, per our discussion of binary last week, what is the largest possible number you can represent with 32 bits? 32 zeros or ones. A whistle's a reasonable answer. What's that translate to? It's 4 billion, right? So it's pretty big, but not infinitely large. Moreover, if you only have the ability to store up to the number 4 billion, how in the world are you going to store something like pi to infinite precision, which has even more digits, obviously, than the number 4 billion? Well, ignore for now that sort of fundamental problem, because we'll see that it's easy to trip over it in more sophisticated applications. For now, let's worry about how you actually display that kind of data. Suppose I actually have a number I've computed that's a floating point value, and it needs to now get printed to the screen. Well, take a look at this. It's a two-line program. Notice that this line here is apparently declaring a variable called answer. And if it's not clear already, notice that when you declare a variable in C, as well as other languages, unlike Scratch, you need to tell the computer what kinds of data is going to go in this variable. You can't just say answer. You can't just say x or y. In the previous example, I said int x. In this example, I'm saying float for a floating point value. Answer. You can call the variable itself anything you want. And in general, x and y and z, though nice in algebra, not so nice in programs when you actually care about looking at them later and remembering what your code does. So a variable called answer is much more reasonable. Well, let me go ahead and run this program after noting that apparently stored in answer is going to be 17 divided by 13, which is going to be like 1 point something. And then I'm going to print what? Well, I'm going to print a floating point value. But per this sort of cryptic syntax here, if you actually put numbers between the percent sign and the format identifier, like F in this case, you can actually specify how many digits to print from a really big number. So 0.2 means show me 2 decimal points, not, say, 8 or 10 or more. So let me go ahead and compile this. So let's go ahead and do gcc-a. What was that? Math 3.c. So math3.c. Let's go ahead and run math 3. Huh. The answer seems to be 1.0. And yet I'm pretty sure 13 doesn't go into 17 equally. In fact, if I use another program, which someone else wrote, that's what 17 divided by 13 is, not 1.00. So what's going on? What's the problem here, would you say? Sorry?
17 and 13.
Yeah, so it looks like there's more subtlety here going on with respect to variables types. So it looks like the number 17 is just what I would call an integer. There's no decimal point. There's nothing after a decimal point. It's just what I would call an integer, whether it's in the programming context or the real world. 13, similarly, is just the number 13. And the semicolon, remember, just marks the end of the line. That has nothing to do with the mathematics. So it appears that C, the language, is assuming that if you take an integer and divide by another integer, by nature of arithmetic on integers, the answer is going to be itself an integer, no matter what. Because that's what you get when you divide an integer type by an integer type, you get back an integer. Now, that integer is supposed to be like 1.3 something. But you can't fit the 0.3 something inside of an int. So what is the language C clearly doing with it? It's just throwing it away. It's throwing away the remainder. It's throwing away everything after the decimal point. So what's perhaps an intuitive fix? Even if you've never coded in C before, if the problem is that I'm dividing two integers, how can I perhaps fix this problem easily? So divide by floating point values. You know, 13 is pretty much like 13.0, right? And 17 is pretty much 17.0. Let me go ahead and rebuild this, recompile this, and rerun math. So there we go. And that does, in fact, check out with the more accurate math we did a moment ago. It is, in fact, supposed to be 1.31. So printf is also doing the rounding for me. Turns out you don't need to do both. If you want to ensure that the answer comes back to be a float, all that matters is that one of the parties in the equation is actually a floating point value. If I rerun this thing, I still get back the same value. But we can also be more specific. And this will be even more useful when we look at other examples still later this week and next. You can also explicitly tell the compiler, you know what, I know this may very well be an integer, 13, but I don't care. Treat it as though it's a floating point. Cast it, typecast it, so to speak, to a different data type altogether. And so long as it makes conceptual sense to change one type to another, well, the compiler will allow this. By contrast, we'll see later in the semester when we actually have data types that aren't primitives, but rather are student data types or a homework data type, things you can sort of create in your own mind and then code up in C. Well, it wouldn't make sense to convert like a floating point number to a student object because they don't really convert from one to the other. But we can specify things manually in that way. Well, what else can we do? Let's take a look at math4.c. This is just a prefab version of the same. Notice that I only changed the denominator there. If we look at math 5, again, you have printouts of all these, hence the speed here. That's the more explicit approach. So let's take things up just slightly further. So variables apparently come in the flavors of, as we said a moment ago, ints, obviously, and floats. If you want to deal with individual characters, which will in fact be useful when we start playing with cryptography, when you want to encipher individual characters in some plain text, that'll be useful. What's a double? It's twice as big as something. Turns out it's twice as big as a float. So a float is 32 bits, which only gives you so much expressiveness. If you need more bigger numbers or more precision, you can use a double instead of float, like in the programs I wrote. And that uses more bits. So a double, for instance, is 64 bits. And that's really rather big, but not necessarily good enough for, say, the more like scientific applications. So there are other approaches still. And then there's this footnote here. It turns out that with ints, you can actually prepend things like keywords like long, short, signed, unsigned, because a char, as we hinted at last week, is just 8 bits, aka 1 byte, which is why you can have up to 256 different characters generally. A double is 64 bits, a float is 32 bits, and an int is 32 bits. And the reason for that is because, actually, I should qualify, on most systems is what I just said true. Most modern systems are ints and floats 32 bits. But it is technically hardware dependent. But if I say short int, take a guess how many bits a short int takes up. So not 32, but 16. Now, why might that actually be useful? Well, back in the day, certainly when memory was expensive and also scarce, you didn't want to just use more bits than you needed to. And even these days, the smaller that hardware gets, the cell phones in your pockets or sensors installed in buildings and bridges, if you have only finite amount of memory, you don't want to just spend it wastefully. And so it's actually very reasonable to assume that if you know your numbers aren't going to get that big, don't spend 32 bits when you can spend half as many. And hence do these data types exist. Suppose you wanted not an extra large float, aka double. Suppose you wanted an integer that's twice as long. What would the keywords there be? So you'd think it's long or long int. For historical reasons, it's rather stupid. It's long, long. So you'll see this. But if you actually want 64 bits of expressiveness for an int, it's actually a long, long. And we'll revisit that before long. That, too, is unintentional. What else exists? Well, it's really nice in other programming languages that aren't C that to have the notion of a Boolean variable. We talked about this briefly in Scratch, the notion of true or false. Turns out we can implement those ourselves, which we will, with something called the CS50 library. There's also be really nice to represent the notion of a string. So anything you might put between double quotes, we call a string, but there's no data type in C called string. There's char, and so that's useful up until the words get longer than one character. But there's no string. It turns out there's char star, so literally a char, the word char and an asterisk. But we try to hide those details in the first couple of weeks, so know that we will be able to introduce these ideas by using what's called the CS50 library. So this is just a file similar in spirit to standard.io.h. We called it CS50.h, and we installed it somewhere on FAS in this case, and next week on CS50.net. If I pull up hi2.c, notice that this program is getting a little more interesting, if only because we're moving away from stupid arithmetic and actually writing programs that print strings. So here we have a variable called name. It's of type string. It's going to store hard-coded fashion, so arguably this isn't the most interesting program yet. It's going to print then, oh hi, comma, and %s, as you might guess, means the placeholder for a string. So after the comma, notice I have to specify what value I want to plug in there. So as you might guess, if I do gcc-o-hi2 of hi2.c, and then run hi2, we get a working, if underwhelming, program, because it always prints out the same thing. Well, let's take things one step further. In hi3, I'm going to take advantage of some of the functions, the mini programs that we implemented in this cs50.h file. Among them are getString, which will help us not only print a string, but get a string from the user by letting them type something at the keyboard, which we have yet to see. And then if we really want, we can get ints from the user's hands, a float, double char, long, longs, and so forth. Well, let's pull this up. hi3.c is a little more interesting in that we're including not only this, so we can use printf, but also this, so that we can use this function. The convention, incidentally, that we chose was to use capital words, whereas most functions in C that come with the language are lowercase. This sort of is meant to be a reminder that these are sort of training wheels for now that will eventually be ripped off. Here we have a sentence, state your name. Here's a variable being defined that says get a string. And then finally, this last line is very similar to before. It's just printing it out. Now, a corner case comment for those of you more savvy. In traditional C, variables have to be defined at the top of the file before any other code. That's not the case with what's called C99, the sort of 1999 version of C, which the course is using. So if you're wondering why this doesn't look like sort of traditional textbooks, that's why. It's a little cleaner to just inline your definitions of variables like we did there. So gcc-o, hi3.c. So what's the problem here? So it turns out that with code that doesn't come with the operating system, code that doesn't come with the compiler, for instance, CS50's library, you kind of need to coax the compiler along by telling it explicitly whose libraries you want to use. Whereas standard IO sort of comes with, CS50.h did not come with Linux. It did not come with GCC. We installed it on the system. So it turns out that if you do see a message like that, it looks cryptic, but you can still kind of garner some information. Undefined reference to get string. What does that mean? The compiler doesn't know what capital get, capital string is. Well, we have to teach it by saying, you know what, use the library, -l for library, called, without any spaces, CS50, and hit enter. That seemed to make it happy. So now if we run hi3, state your name. All right, David. Well, that's great. We just sort of reinvented that wheel. Let's try it again. State your name. How about Jansu? Wow, so now we actually have a dynamic program. So where can we go from this? So I went on the internet before class, and I Googled the following. So obfuscated C. And this led me to Wikipedia, among other places. I'll pull up the Wikipedia article. Obfuscated C contests were begun about 20 plus years ago, and the goal is to write the most cryptic program in C, or even other languages, that you possibly can. So this crazy thing that whoever wrote this article pasted in is apparently a program that looks very unlike anything you will do in this class. So this is sort of the other extreme of how cryptic things can get, that apparently estimates the value of pi by analyzing its own circular structure there, which is just a really big string. This thing here is apparently a flight simulator, which, if compiled in the proper way, will actually depict a plane flying. I chose this one, Holloway.c, unrelated to our own Glenn Holloway on staff. But notice this. Again, this is again sort of the other extreme. You're not going to be writing stuff like this because the TFs aren't going to want to read stuff like this. But take a guess. What does this do? I challenge those more comfortable to answer this. What does this do? Ooh, yeah?
Is this a quad?
It's not a quine. So a quine, which is also a fun thing to Google and look it up on the Wikipedia, is a program that prints its own source code, which is actually harder to do than it sounds. Well, let's go ahead and do this. Let's sort of solve it by compiling it. Let's call it Holloway. Let's do Holloway.c, enter. And here we go. So again, before, it's crazy stuff that someone won a contest by writing. And Holloway. Wow. We'll see you Wednesday. See you Wednesday.